Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Srimad Bhagavatam Canto 7, Chapter 11, The Perfect Society, Four Social Classes, Texts 33 and 34. Upyamanam Mahuchetram Swayam Nirviryatam Iyat Nakalpate punah suttai Uptam bijam chanashyati. Translation. My dear king, if an agricultural field is cultivated again and again, the power of its production decreases, and whatever seeds are sown there are lost. Just as drops of ghee on a fire never extinguish the fire, but a flood of ghee will. Similarly, overindulgence in lusty desires mitigates such desires entirely. Purport. If one continuously sprinkles drops of ghee on a fire, the fire will not be extinguished. But if one suddenly puts a lump of ghee on a fire, the fire may possibly be extinguished entirely. Similarly, those who are too sinful and have thus been born in the lower classes are allowed to enjoy sinful activities fully, for there is a chance that these activities will become detestful to them and they will get the opportunity to be purified. I will attempt to speak on this verse from a global perspective. We'll analyze the different elements. We find the example of an agricultural field cultivated again and again, losing its power of production. Now we'll speak briefly about the world agricultural situation. Bhagavatam includes everything. And then we hear about the drops of ghee on the fire as opposed to the flood of ghee on the fire. So the drops of ghee on the fire, the Kama Bindu, I will compare to India. And the flood of ghee, shall we say the Kama Sindhu, I will compare to the Western world. And then I will also try to speak about Lord Chaitanya and how he described his senses being overwhelmed by the sense objects. Of course, that is completely another realm. So let us see what we can do to humbly comment upon this verse. First of all, the agricultural field cultivated again and again, losing the power of production. This is common sense agricultural understanding. Let us look at the world food situation. This is something that concerns Srila Prabhupada. Throughout his purports, he makes reference that the real economy is simply food production, not getting paper money, working hard to get some papers. One should work by growing food. Up until the 20th century, growing food was the greatest challenge facing humanity. We're not speaking about one country or another country. We're talking about the whole globe. So much of human endeavor, for as much as historians can remember, a few thousand years, So much of human endeavor has been tied up in how to grow enough food to live. In the past, for example, when I was a little boy, growing up in the 50s, the parents in the neighborhood would always say, "Eat all the food on your plate. Remember the starving children in India." "Be thankful for what you have." That was the common saying in the neighborhood. "Remember the starving children in India and in China. Eat every morsel on your plate." But what they don't tell you is that even in the West, for example, you look at London around the time of Srila Prabhupada's birth, the 1890s, for the working class poor in London, and there were millions of them, you know what their life expectancy average was? 20 years. Because the food problem was so intense that they were not getting enough to live beyond the average age of 20 years old. Even the British Army, in trying to staff its imperialism all over the globe, had great difficulty because they found 50% of their recruits were too weak and too short to fit the army requirements because of malnutrition. We have forgotten how so much of human endeavor historically has been tied up in growing food. In Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says, "Kshigoraksham vanijam." Krishna is Goraksha, cow protection. Balaram is Kshiraksha, land protection. Krishna carries the rope for binding the back legs of the cows, and Balaram carries the plow for taking care of the land. Most of human endeavor for sustenance is meant to be involved with food production. And it was a challenge up until the 20th century. Then what happened? The so-called Green Revolution, chemical agriculture, flooded the globe. You can ignore the laws of nature. You can ignore the natural cycle of fertility in the land. You can cheat just by using synthetic chemicals. Then you can indulge in monoculture, just growing the same crop on the land again and again and again, contrary to this common sense information given in Bhagavatam. The chemical agriculture will save you. So there was a tremendous flood of food in the world. And naturally, people were happy. Even in India, the Green Revolution came, and it seemed like the chronic food problems that India was known or reputed to have in the past would all be solved. This is civilization, though, of the demons. Because now the effects are being reaped. You can't cheat nature. It all bounces back on you. All the chemical fertilizers, all the chemical pesticides that are being used are creating such a hazardous condition, not simply for the food you eat, but also for the land itself. The land is no longer able to provide bounteous harvests. For a while, this is Rajagun, mode of passion. "Oh, just look at what these chemicals have done. They've tripled our output. All glories to the scientists. All glories to our saviors, the chemical industry." So for a while, things were going great. But now, it's time to pay for the party. Environmental scientists are in a complete tizzy. That we have destroyed the land. We have destroyed the water. If you look at the USA, its breadbasket is the Midwest. States surrounding the Mississippi River, which runs from northern USA to the Gulf of Mexico in the south. So, the Mississippi River carries huge amounts of fertilizer runoff, nitrogen fertilizer. It's got to go somewhere. So it's all pouring into the Gulf of Mexico, and there's a huge area in the Gulf which is completely dead of any life. Nothing can live. Even you go to our farm, our ISKCON farm, Gita Nagri in the USA, which Srila Prabhupada spoke about how much potential it had for producing food. In fact, one Amish farmer just recently told the devotees, you know, this land you have is so wonderful and so productive. You give me this land, and in 5 years, I will have paid for the land, and I'll be making good profit. So, Gita Nagri is in the middle of nowhere in the state of Pennsylvania. Yet, the river that flows by Gita Nagri is so polluted, you can't swim in it. Why? Because all the chemical fertilizer runoff from the farms, neighboring farms, goes into the river. And so here you are in the middle of nowhere. No cities around. No towns around. And there's pollution. You can't swim in the river. What to speak of? Drink from the river. So this is mode of passion civilization. By our brilliance, we'll create an artificial solution. And everyone will be happy. So for a short time, there was this enormous burst of food production. No longer was growing food considered to be a challenge anymore for human society. Now, nature is demanding its pay. And intelligent scientists are concerned. How are we going to make it in the future? Then you look at the social trends of the world. What if India and China start to imitate more and more the American and Australian meat-based diet? How can the environment handle that? The symbol of success and affluence is to have lots of meat on your plate. How can the world's environment handle? Just take India. Forget China. In 20 years or so, India is predicted to have more people than China. So if the growing middle class in India decides, and they are deciding that, we want all the trappings of affluence. We're not villagers. We are the world. And that means meat. There's no way the world's environment, the globe, the environment can handle that. The soil is depleted. The food is polluted. And still, the nimble-minded chemical scientists are coming out with more ingenious solutions. I mean, if you're a demon, this what I'm going to say now makes complete sense. Just like you take the policy of Monsanto. They're very eager to do business in India. In fact, the U.S. government has arranged a nice trade with India. Nuclear secrets we'll give to India, and India gives a free rein to the American chemical industry. So, what is the stated plan of Monsanto? We want to sell you our special seeds And the nature of these seeds is that because they're all synthetically modified, genetically modified, the nature of these seeds is that they can only be grown if you use our fertilizer. So they have a stated policy. Their corporate goal is to control the world's food supply. Now, if you're a businessman, this sounds great. Just what a monopoly. Everyone buys our seeds. Not only do they have to buy our seeds, they have to buy fertilizer from us. They have to buy insecticide from us because it's a whole package deal. You can't get outside the package. Never mind the effects on nature. Never mind the effects on people's health. Some other scientists will sort that out. We have an obligation to our shareholders. Yes, intelligent persons are wondering, how can things go on like this? But who has the capacity to control their senses? Let's take, for example, the new president of the USA, a brilliant fellow, very well read. And a devotee told me he heard him in an interview point blank say, there's no doubt that the meat diet is destroying the economy of our country, of the whole world. He could just recite all the statistics, how raising grains and feeding the grains to the animals and then eating the animals is so inefficient, it's causing hunger problems. But then he confesses, yes, but I know all these things, but I'm a sinner. I enjoy my barbecue. What is the use of knowledge without sense control? This will be the story of today's so-called civilization. You may know so much, but if you can't control your senses, all the results of your knowledge is destroyed. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, mogasha moga karmano moga jnana vichesaha. All your hopes are defeated. Mogasha moga karmano. All your activities result in zero. Moga jnana, the effects of your knowledge are all spoiled because you've partaken of the nature of deviance. Deviant, that's another word for demon. Sometimes intellectuals and academic persons, they don't like this term demon. It sounds they think it's fanatical. Some will use the word deviant. Holiness Bhakti Tirthamar has taught me that. You say deviant instead of demoniac. If you want to be stronger, you say perverted. No one likes to be known as a pervert. Our point has always been that civilization is off track. The profit motive rules everything. Just like recently in the USA, I believe I spoke about this at the Bhabha Institute of Nuclear Research. USA, land of the free, home of the brave. That's what they say about themselves. So, freedom of the press. So some journalists had uncovered a story about genetically modified food, how it was producing very dangerous effects in rats who were experimented upon and given this genetically modified food. So the news reporters, in the true American spirit of freedom of information, freedom of discussion, they made a huge story about it. And they were ready to go on the air, ready to broadcast. Then Monsanto, the multinational chemical giant, sent its representative to the TV station. And immediately, the whole program was canceled. Monsanto, these news reporters, they described, the Monsanto representative called them in and said, look, let's settle this nicely. I give you $200,000 and you never talk about this story again. $200,000. But these reporters were very idealistic. No, no, we refuse to surrender. we are doing our duty to the people. The people need this information. We are dedicated to the news, truth, justice. The Monsanto representative looked at them and said, look, we decide what the news is. We will tell this TV station you're working for that you're fired. What are you going to do about it? He told them directly, Monsanto decides what the news is, and you will follow. This is just one slice, tiny slice of the pie, showing you what's happening in the world on a huge global scale. Everything is profit. Even when people know there's something wrong, they can't do anything about it, because who can control the senses? At the Bubba Institute of Nuclear Research, I spoke about ExxonMobil, because I had to explain this because the very nice persons in the audience, about 30, had come to the program, and very nice gentlemen. And naturally, they were idealistic. Through our research into nuclear energy, we'll save the world and like that, and we'll avoid all the hazards, we'll avoid all the risks, trust us. So, I briefly, of course, discussed the hazards of nuclear power plants. They knew all that better than me. They didn't need me to tell them that. But my point in briefly discussing that was to present to them the human factor. You may have taken all the technological safeguards. You may have advanced all the procedures for how the nuclear power plants run. But what about the persons who supervise all this? What about the government, which is supposed to oversee the regulations? Because there are persons involved, and persons can't control their senses at any moment. There can be great damage because you haven't trained human beings how to control their senses. So they kind of looked at me a little, all right, Swamiji, all right. One can say like that, but we shouldn't get so worked up about these things. After all, when you have the superior scientific knowledge, all obstacles can be overcome. There'll always be a little bit of moral problem, but that's outside the realm of science. Leave these moral issues to someone else. The main thing is the scientific advancement, which will carry the day. Superior knowledge. So, I said, all right, you have to kind of fight fire with fire. So I said, okay, I'm going to have to get down on their level and let's be for real, guys. I said, did you know? Of course, last year, ExxonMobil, the most profitable multinational corporation in the world, came away with, at that time, 2 years ago when I spoke, it was $45 billion clear profit. Now it's over 50. The data has just come out, over $50 billion clear profit. Did you know that ExxonMobil has a slush fund of a mere few million dollars, pennies for them. And they go around approaching scientists that, look, there's a lot of hubbub. There's a lot of unnecessary commotion about global warming and climate change. Now, we all know that the jury is still out, you know, whether such a thing is really true. Now, we don't want that you give any false information. But simply, we do have some research funds meant for you to stimulate you to simply publicly say that global warming, it's not for sure. Just problematize the whole issue. And just to help you in thinking, we have $10,000 for your first published essay. Second essay, $50,000. Now, ExxonMobil, they admit to this. They say, no, we're not trying to spread false propaganda. We're just trying to create a level playing field. We just want all sides heard. And we're simply encouraging scientists who just want to present an alternative point of view, that's all. What could be wrong with that? What could be the harm? So I presented this situation to the researchers at the Bubba Institute of Nuclear Research. I said, all right, you presented me with your idealism. You presented me with how noble your pursuit is and how pure your quest is for scientific knowledge. What would you do if ExxonMobil came knocking on your door offering you $10,000 to write an essay? Who here would refuse? They all look down. Would you turn that offer down? It's not that you have to deny climate change, global warming. Just present that it's not well understood. There's much confusion about it. And who can say what is really true? How many of you would be able to refuse that kind of economic stimulus? They continued to look at the floor. So I decided I would rub it in just a little bit more. You know? I said, all right, let's say that a few of you could refuse. What would happen, though, when you go home and tell your wife? And they really looked at the floor. What will your wife say if you tell her you have an offer of $10,000 just to write an essay, you know, saying that a particular scientific issue is very confused and there's no clear-cut verdict either way? Your wife would be on your case like anything. Take the money. Take the money. We need a bigger flat. Put it in the bank for our child's university education. Put it in the bank to get a special tutor so our child can prepare for the exams now at the age of 5 in order to go to IIT. I said, you know that's what's going to happen. First of all, practically none of you will refuse. And if you did, your wife would never let you refuse. So just see. One minute you're telling me about the noble pursuit of science and how, everyone has scruples and is very careful in their research. Everyone's above board. The next minute, just see how easily you would deviate from your principles. Therefore, as Srila Prabhupada said, it's the civilization of the demons, or we can modify it, civilization of the deviants. The situation is becoming such, so intense, that the dean of the Yale School of Environment, Yale University School of Environment, has been in existence for 100 years. The dean has been called by Time magazine as the ultimate insider. He used to be for many years in charge of the UN development for the whole UN development funds for the whole world. He was a presidential advisor. He's a Yale graduate, Yale undergrad, Yale law, and so now he's gone back to the as they say, Mother Yale. He's gone back to Mother Yale, and he's dean of the School of Environment. So he said, for 40 years, I have been using my legal prowess to fight multinational corporations in the court, trying to save the environment. Now I realize it's just all useless. No one listens. He said, I'm calling on all the young people to start a movement of civil disobedience, just like Gandhi. That will be the only solution, the only way to make the point that life as it is now cannot go on. It's impossible. You cannot change the laws of nature. You can change the laws of your government. You can change the laws of your city. But the laws of nature don't change. So this is what's happening. I have been told that, of course, environmental concerns are not such a hot issue in India yet. 10 years and it'll come. Because right now, everyone wants to catch up with the Kama Sindhu, the ocean of lust. In pursuing that Kama Sindhu, the ocean of lust, you lose all intelligence. Let's look at the past cultural situation in India. It's been the Kama Bindu, the drops of ghee on the fire. When I deal a lot with, as you know, overseas Indian students and young professionals in Australia. And they all come from backgrounds of which the little drops, Kama Bindu, of ghee on the fire. They have some culture, some restraint, and then they come to Australia and they just see the Kama Sindhu everywhere. Just the flood of ghee being poured on the fire. So they're simultaneously repulsed and attracted at the same time. They tell me. Something makes... They're repulsed in certain ways, like, this is too much. I mean, a few drops of ghee on the fire, that is all right. But a whole inundation of ghee on the fire, this is just beyond our imagination. But at the same time, look at the people. They just drown in this flood of ghee on the fire so happily. Maybe they have a superior lifestyle in some ways, to have no inhibitions, no cultural taboos, no restraints. They become intrigued. Something in their gut tells them, ooh, this is too much. But then something in their mind, especially they're all, you know, seeing pornography on the internet, and they're, you know, just walking down the city streets is a pornographic event. And so their intelligence is very curious, like, ooh, maybe there is something to this. And a few of them have come to the conclusion, the Kama Sindhu, pouring an ocean of ghee on the fire, that is a superior way of life. And because it's a superior way of life, once we Indians get into it, we'll be the best. Yeah, they say like that. We have been very hesitant to get into the Kama Sindhu. We've been just dropping, we're just letting little drops of Kama go on the fire. We can show the whole world. We can compete on any level. Enough of these cultural taboos, enough of these restraints. Let us get into it. We'll show. We'll show the world. So, we can see that from the psychological point of view, the policy of putting a few drops of ghee on the fire never extinguishes the fire. And this is why, at least in the overseas representatives of India that I meet, young professionals, university students, they are in agony because they're tantalizing themselves with just these few drops of ghee on the fire, and the appetite is never satisfied, the fire is never extinguished. There's always this yearning for more. There's always this agony. Well, my parents and grandparents didn't raise me in this way, but they're on the other side of the ocean now. It's just me here in a foreign country. No one will know what I do. No one will know where I go. My relatives will not, you know, they'll never find out what I'm doing. I can fly back to India twice a year and present myself as respectable. But meanwhile, while I'm in Australia, I can experiment in so many ways, indulge in so many things. I don't know if I can pass up this opportunity. It's just too much. So they're tortured because of the policy of little drops of ghee on the fire. The fire hasn't gone out. Now, you look at life in the West. The flood of ghee on the fire. it would seem that this is an attractive policy if you want to get over material desires. Why tantalize yourself with just a few comma bindus? Just fully dive into it. Learn your lesson and then walk away. Is that how the system works? We read in the purport, if one continuously sprinkles drops of ghee on a fire, the fire will not be extinguished. But if one suddenly puts a lump of ghee on a fire, the fire may possibly be extinguished entirely. Similarly, those who are too sinful and have thus been born in the lower classes are allowed to enjoy sinful activities fully, for thus there is a chance that these activities will become detestable to them and they will get the opportunity to be purified. So possibly there's a chance. But this, for this kind of purificatory process, you pay a heavy price. So this is what I have to explain to the overseas students and young professionals. It's, things aren't as attractive as they may appear. The Westerners have paid an extraordinary price for the flood of ghee on the fire. What's the price? Psychological devastation, family structure completely destroyed, no integrity, no sense control, not the slightest bit of discipline at all. The social problems are extraordinary. Just look at the UK. The UK is a social disaster. If you just go to Bhaktivedanta Manor, you'll never know it. You'll see all the Mercedes and BMWs on Sundays they're in the parking lot. You'll see all the young Indian professionals and the older, well-established Indian families. And you think, oh, the UK, very tidy country in the British sense, very orderly. But the Indian population in the UK is at best 4% of the population. What are the British doing? Forget the old Victorian perception of the British. The colonial overlords. Their social statistics in terms of divorce, in terms of drug use, in terms of child abuse, in every social category, they are the pits. The worst in Europe. They make the USA look like such a loca in terms of behavior. Now, I'm speaking in terms of social statistics. In the USA, the statistics for mundane religion, at worst, and maybe some sincere piety at best, 1 out of 3 Americans goes to church. In the UK, no British go to church. It's only the immigrants from Africa, the Caribbean. Same in Australia, New Zealand, British-derived countries. Christianity died 50 years ago. So you can study there the effects of the flood of lust. All right, every once in a while, some young person comes crawling out of the disaster. Oh, I've had it. Oh, so much sense gratification. I don't want any more. I'm sick of it. Every once in a while, someone comes crawling out. Yeah. But then you look at the condition they're in. They're totally devastated, totally destroyed. Psychologically, they're nuts. Physically, their health is a disaster. So I was explaining to devotees in the UK who want to preach to the British, you have to understand what you're dealing with. You cannot take persons like that and just put saffron on and put them in the Brahmachari Ashram. It takes at least 3 years for them to regain their sanity. So then there's a great sociological problem because the British, they're proud due to their history, but in terms of the present reality, their lifestyles are abominable. So they come to the Hare Krishna temples, especially the manor, to a lesser extent, Soho, and they see all these successful, well-polished, cultured young Indians and older Indians you know, driving the Mercedes, family intact, there's a mother home, there's a father home, all these abnormalities. Their marriages are arranged in a nice way. And so these young British, they just feel, well, they feel envious. Like, what are these people doing in our country? Because all they can aspire for is to be a bus driver, you know, to collect fares, you know, for the metro or something like that. And they look around and they see all these, you know, these young Indians wondering, well, should I be a share trader? Should I be a lawyer? Should I be an accountant? And so they just feel totally out of place. And they can't, the British, we're just using them as an example, just like we use the Australians as an example. I'm equally disposed to to all living entities. We're just pointing out the realities, that's all. We are Samadarshans. So these young people, they feel so out of place. They can't compete. They can't have any sense of self-worth. And Krishna consciousness presupposes some kind of human tendencies. And compared to when Srila Prabhupada was preaching on Second Avenue in New York, Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, compared to then, then was the Satya Yuga in terms of Western behavior. Back then, when Srila Prabhupada was preaching to the youth of America, a young person didn't go off the rails until 18 or 19 years old when he or she went to university. You left home, you went to the university, and then you went wild. Now, it happens at the age of 12 and 13. So this is the situation of the world in pursuing the Kama Sindhu, the ocean of ghee dropping on the fire, the ocean of lusty desires. Possibly someone becomes tired of it all, finds it detestable. But that's after totally destroying their intelligence, totally destroying their physical health. So I tried to explain this to the overseas Indian students and professionals, the young ones, that I know you're being tortured because you've been following the policy of the Kama Bindu. Yeah. A few drops of Kama, a few drops of ghee on the fire, but the fire's not going out. It's even more hungry. A little bit of pornography on the internet here, a wild movie there. Somehow they arrange for little drops of the Kama Bindu. And just done in a way that doesn't threaten the educational pursuits, doesn't threaten the job potential, but it's there. But because they're just little drops of Kama, little drops of ghee on the fire, they're tortured because the fire is not satisfied. As the verse says here, just as drops of ghee on a fire never extinguish the fire. So they're like hung up between two worlds. I give classes to them. I say, okay, now I'm addressing the hybrids. You have 1 foot in India, you have 1 foot in Australia. And it's a torturous life for them. They can't go fully one way or the other. They have seen the glories of the West, the Kama Sindhu. They can't quite bring themselves to that ocean, but at the same time, they're not satisfied by the Kama Bindu, the drops of Kama. So they're just tortured all the time. Oh, this is what's going on inside. Of course, generally they won't say, I have to bring it out of them. Isn't this the situation? Everyone just... just silence. I know, silence means agreement. Then after the seminar, they come and see me privately. Swamiji, yes, what you have said is right. I'm fighting such a great battle. And so this is what's happening. This is the choice that Kali Yuga presents to you now. Either the Kama Bindu or the Kama Sindhu. It's not fair, is it? How can you survive? You go crazy. Either you go crazy with the Kama Bindu being tortured by one little drop after another, or you go crazy from the Kama Sindhu, the ocean of lust, which totally destroys your society, your family, your mind, your body. This is all that's going on in the world today. Let us contrast this very hellish use of the senses with the lifestyle of the supreme bhakta, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is showing you that bhakti is completely sensory. We don't want to say sensual because that word has implications. But sensory. Bhakti involves full use of the senses. And Lord Chaitanya demonstrates that sensory capacity of bhakti in its utmost perfection. Let's go to Jagannath Puri. Lord Chaitanya is looking at the Jagannath deities in the temple, as frequently described by Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami. Lord Chaitanya, suddenly while looking at Lord Jagannath, what does he see? Sakshat Brajendra Nandana. He sees directly the son of Maharaj Nanda. So, Chaitanya Charitamrita describes what's happening to Lord Chaitanya. Sometimes you see Lord Chaitanya is in full immersion of internal ecstasy. Other times he's partially having external consciousness of the world around him. And other times he's fully conscious of the external world around him. Nevertheless, in spite of these three basic divisions, the thread underlying all these three states is that actually Lord Chaitanya is always fully absorbed in ecstatic love of Krishna, and his bodily functions are going on just like a potter's wheel turns. Just by one push of the potter, the wheel keeps turning. So Lord Chaitanya is bathing, his eating, his going to the Jagannath temple. These activities are going on automatically. But inside him, he's always absorbed in Krishna Viraha, ecstatic separation from Krishna. He's looking at Lord Jagannath. He sees suddenly Krishna, the son of Maharaj Nanda. And Lord Chaitanya describes how all his senses start running off in different directions. A very painful situation, which is the utmost ecstasy on the spiritual platform. Because in the spiritual realm, pain is an equal source of bliss as pleasure is. This is knowledge of Advaita Gyan, non-duality. Non-duality doesn't mean there's no variegatedness. That's the Mayavad conception. But true knowledge of non-duality means that all the varieties are there, but they all have the effect of eternity, knowledge, and bliss. So therefore, in the spiritual world, pain is ecstatic. Pleasure is ecstatic. Impersonals can't understand this. Mundane scholars have a difficult time understanding Lord Chaitanya. Often they say, he was a great social reformer. He did wonders for the people in India. But then, in Jagannath Puri, he lost the plot. He became just absorbed in ecstasies and became useless for the welfare of humanity. Often they say like that. Because they don't understand what is the science of bhakti. You can't understand that from the outside. You can only understand it through disciplic succession. We're understanding it to some degree because of the degree of our investment in devotional service. So, Lord Chaitanya described, his eyes are attracted by the beauty of Krishna. His nose is attracted by the fragrance coming from Krishna's lotus feet. His tongue is attracted by the taste of sweetness of the Lord. His ears are attracted by the Lord's words and the sound of his flute. And his tactile sense, his sense of touch, is attracted by the coolness of Krishna's body. This is all going on at once. Chaitanya Charitamrita describes that after this particular incident of Lord Chaitanya seeing Jagannath as Sakshat Brajendananda, he went to his home, and as always, he passed the night feeling ecstatic separation from Krishna in the company of Srup Damodar and Ramananda Roy. And they knew how to aid Lord Chaitanya's ecstatic feelings of pure love and separation. Srup Damodar would sing certain songs. Ramananda Roy would recite certain verses, all to aid Lord Chaitanya in his full and pure sensory experience of love of Krishna in separation. In other words, this is nothing about religious theology or a belief. You're dealing with senses and sense objects in perfection. We find a very beautiful point mentioned in Krishna book, that the platform of sense gratification is there in both material life and spiritual life. The only difference is who is the sense gratification for. I often explain this point in the West so that people relax. There is sense gratification in Krishna consciousness. Immediately you can see the whole audience. Because they have this fear that if they take to Krishna consciousness, what are they going to do with their senses? They have this stereotype idea that bhakti yoga means just to bite your tongue and clench your... You can't do this, you can't do that. All the variegated, delightful activities are taken away from you. So I have to explain to them, indeed, that sense gratification is there in spiritual life and material life. The crucial point is, who is the sense gratification meant for? So Lord Chaitanya is demonstrating the perfection of the senses and the sense objects. That is bhakti. A verse is recited that makes Lord Chaitanya remember a verse that Srimati Radharani spoke to Vishakha, in which Srimati Radharani described the hearts, the consciousness of the gopis in Vrindavan to be like high hills. And even though those hills are very high, the nectar of Krishna's beauty, Sondaryamrita, is like a huge wave that floods over even these high hills. And all of the senses become attracted to Krishna. Lord Chaitanya describes himself in that way. What can I do? I can't blame my senses. I can't become angry at my senses. Because Krishna is all attractive. Every feature of Krishna is unlimitedly attractive. How can I blame my senses? How can I become angry at them? He describes his mind to be like a horse. And the five senses all want to ride that horse at the same time and go in different directions. So Lord Chaitanya says, how can I live? How can anyone maintain their life riding a horse which is being pulled in five different directions at once? A very beautiful, impactful analogy. He describes the Krishna Rupamrita Sindhu, the ocean of the nectar of Krishna's beauty. How can the senses resist? Each sense is pursuing fully the sense object. The eyes are pursuing the form of Krishna. The tongue is pursuing the Adharamrita, the confidential taste, the sweetness of Krishna's lips. The ears, Lord Chaitanya says, Krishna's words. Where is the woman who can resist Krishna's sweet words? It's impossible. no matter how chaste they are, when Krishna speaks, the words enter the consciousness. And like a bird making a nest, the words enter the ears, make a nest there. Who can resist this? The fragrance coming from Krishna. The coolness of Krishna's body, more cool than millions upon millions of moons. Who can resist these things? So Lord Chaitanya presents himself in this way. How can I live when each one of my senses is unlimitedly attracted to Krishna and wants to go its own way? Each one wants to ride the horse in its direction. There's no way the horse, in other words, his mind, there's no way that one can stay intact in such circumstances. So in this way, Lord Chaitanya is describing the perfection of sensory overload. The flood of sensory overload. So you see that sensory overload in perfection, and now in the age of Kali, you see that sensory overload presented in the demoniac way, the deviant way, the perverted way. So much of our Krishna conscious persuasion is meant to show people that there is variegated sensory experience in bhakti. And faith, shraddha, advances once persons indeed start to taste something for their senses. The prasad for the tongue. The holy name for the ears. Bouncing and jostling with the Vaishnavas in kirtan. Yes, that is satisfying the sense of touch. You see in the kirtan, like last night, the brahmacharis grabbing each other, spinning each other around. And this is the perfection of the sense of touch. It is there in the shastra. Once you realize that your senses have full opportunity for expression in Krishna consciousness, you finally become peaceful. Up until that point, it's a bit of a challenge. You've got different voices trying to enter your ear. Remember what you did in the past, or remember what you could have done in the past and still have a chance to do now. And this kind of makes you schizophrenic. But as you advance in bhakti, you become peaceful, because advancement in bhakti means understanding my senses will be fully satisfied in the most variegated ways, the most wonderful ways in bhakti yoga. And Lord Chaitanya, as the supreme bhakta, demonstrates the height of perfection in what happens to the senses in contact with the divine sense objects of Krishna's form, Krishna's fragrance, Krishna's touch, Krishna's sounds. So I hope I've covered all the points that we set out to cover in today's lecture. This verse contains impetus for speaking for days. So please remember something about the current world situation. Srila Prabhupada was not speaking like an old school villager who's too attached to Gandhi's village plan. No. He's speaking as one who understands how the world should function. Anad bhavati bhutani. Living entities subsist on food grains. The purpose of the human form of life is to take care of your material needs very simply, in the easiest way. Live a peaceful life so your mind is not so disturbed, so you can become Krishna conscious. That is civilization as it should be. Now we have such a complicated version of civilization, which is destroying people physically and mentally. What I was explaining at the Prayana Festival on Wednesday, because there were some professors at MIT from the USA, they were there, so I had to put some things into the lecture. It's all Garanga Prabhu's fault because he came over before the lecture and whispered to me, there's professors from MIT here. You know, he knows how to agitate me. He knew I couldn't resist. So I reached in the back of my mental files and pulled out some statistics. I said, did you know that according to the latest official U.S. government survey, nearly half of American university students have at least one psychiatric disorder? At least one. So what does that say about the Kama Sindhu? What does that say about all the scientific and technological advancement? The students are crazy. And the survey said at least one psychiatric disorder. This is the result of the civilization of demons, deviants. So then, the Indian students and young professionals abroad, they're face to face with this. But because they don't have a Krishna conscious immersion, they become bewildered. They're actually in agony. Oh, this looks good. Even though it looks bad, it looks good. Certainly, my grandmother would not approve of me considering doing such things, but grandmother is in some village in Gujarat, and here I am now in Melbourne, in Sydney. It's agony. They tell me in confidential moments. It's actually agony. They want to, but they can't. They want to, but they can't. I can sympathize. My mother was, she's a very strict Christian lady who kept a strong grip on the family, even though she's raising her children in the city. I have to be careful what I say because sometimes she listens to the lectures, you know, she goes online to find the lectures. But, anyway, I'll say it. It can appear that she's a proud lady. So, you know, one son, you know, has gone to Yale. Other middle son, he's a doctor who's in charge. He's in charge of a big charitable foundation with an endowment of $150 million. He runs a clinic in charge of many doctors and. Youngest son, he went to Harvard. He's now a vice president of Toyota North America. So I'm just saying this so you understand. Mother gets a bit, shall we say, full of herself. And she says it's all because of their strong religious training. So anyway, she raised us very strictly in the city. And we didn't like it as teenagers. We looked all around and saw the teenagers having a good time with the Kama Sindhu. We didn't even get Kama Bindu. And all around is the Kama Sindhu. So, I remember sometimes as a 14-year-old boy looking out the window of the house, seeing the other teenagers in the neighborhood just freely cavorting with the opposite sex, just acting in so many loose ways. And I remember at 14 just falling on my knees and praying to God, oh God, why did you give me this intelligence that I have to figure everything out before I do it? Why can't I be like those teenagers just letting the good times roll, just getting into it? God, why did you do this to me? I have to be honest and say, yes, when I was 14, I was actually praying to God like that. Why do I have to think about everything before I do it? Why can't we just, you know, dive into the Kama Sindhu? And of course, as soon as I would start to think like that too much, or even make some slight step to act in that way, Mother was right there. No. You see these teenagers? They look happy now. Wait 3 years when they graduate from high school and it's time to go to the university. Then you'll see who's actually having the fun. She would really give us the propaganda, you know. If you want to be successful in life, you have to be three things. You have to be a scholar. You have to be a capitalist. And you have to be a Christian. So I can understand, the agony that these overseas, students from India, the young professionals, I can understand the agony they're going through. It's really torture. You know? And unless you quickly come to a higher platform, you're going to be destroyed because you can't hold out with that agony. Something has to give. The kama bindu, the drops of ghee on the fire, is not satisfying you. It's just leaving you more hungry and unsatisfied. And so then you naturally start to consider, what about the kama sindhu? Just putting a flood of ghee on the fire. That seems to be the easy solution, and everyone all around is doing like that overseas. Of course, now that option is fully present in Mumbai, Delhi, Bangalore. It's all becoming in your face now. Let's show the rest of the world that we can excel at the Kama Sindhu, just like we excelled at the Kama Bindu. This time we have now is a great opportunity for preaching Krishna consciousness, because people are in between so many situations and mentalities. They're in between the Kama Bindu and the Kama Sindhu. They're in between in terms of will there be a glorious economic future or will there not? Everything is quite unstable these days. Mm-hmm. The old story that people base their lives on is looking very suspicious in so many ways. But where's the new story? It's a very wonderful and glorious time to be giving Krishna consciousness to others. So therefore, we pray to Lord Nityananda, Lord Chaitanya, that we can effectively be instruments during this time of great opportunity. We'll stop here and ask if you have any questions. I hope I did not overdose you with too much mundane information. I hope you could see the Krishna conscious connection.
Flooded it with CC. With Chaitanya Charitamrita.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, I'm just trying to understand this analogy given in Srimad Bhagavatam of the flood of the ghee poured on the fire, whether that implies that those people who have such excess enjoyment, they won't have any samskaras, that also the samskaras by the enjoyment will be extinguished as well? I mean, like as a fire?
No, it doesn't say that there'll be no reactions. That's the point I was making. There is a chance they'll find these activities detestable to them, and then they'll get the opportunity to be purified. But that doesn't mean that, all the bad effects are just washed away by their, pouring the flood of ghee on the fire. No, you've got to pay the price. That was my point. Okay, you may, after an overdose of sense gratification, you may say, oh, I'm burned out. This is a common expression in the West. I'm burned out. You know, I'll give you examples. Sometimes I have to deal with devotees who, they're very wealthy parents. I'll give you one example, just so you understand what I'm dealing with. There's one devotee, very respectable family in New Zealand. Srinathji Prabhu has been there. Very tidy. He was very impressed by the tidiness, the orderliness of the country, the natural beauty. People seem to behave very orderly, well-mannered. But I know what goes on inside the houses. I have to deal with that as in preaching Krishna consciousness. So one devotee, he told me. Yeah, he wasn't shocked, but he just told me in a matter-of-fact way. He was home visiting his parents. And, nice upper-middle-class home, very respectable. Father has his own business. Mother is managing a chain of bookshops. So he's just the devotee. He was just about 22 years old. He was sitting in the living room, and the mother comes in from work, managing, her chain of bookshops. And she has a stack of magazines in her hand, and she just nonchalantly, just casually, walks by him and says, "Oh, hi, son. I'm home from work now. I've got some nice pornographic magazines for you." It's part of life. So her own son had to tell her, "Mother, please. I can do without that." "All right, son, if that's the way you feel. I mean, this must be in a bad mood today." Yeah, that's what she thought. "You're a little touchy today, aren't you?" "Yeah, I'm your mother. I have a nice stack of pornographic magazines that I got free from the bookshop because I worked there. And it's all part of life, wholesomeness, We're a wholesome family." This gives you insight into the mentality. So many other devotees, I know, for example, from the UK, one very, very wealthy. Very, very wealthy. But the boy, as a teenager, he told me he spent every weekend in the clubs of London spending minimum £200 per weekend on the drug ecstasy and paying the club fees to enter the club and dance weekend after weekend after weekend after weekend. And so the end result is that his health becomes totally devastated. His mind is in pieces. And then, fortunately, such a person comes to Krishna consciousness. Now, what are we to do as Krishna conscious leaders? Put on saffron, enter the Brahmachari ashram. No. Where is the remedial program for getting such persons together again so they regain their physical health and their mental sanity? Where's that program? So I've explained before, I think last time I was here, in my opinion, this is what has stopped the preaching in the West, that the older leaders, they don't want to deal with this stuff. Things are worse than when they were young devotees. Now they're seeing the effects of persons who have overindulged in the senses since the age of 13. How is Krishna consciousness going to deal with them? And it's affecting university students also. So therefore, there's no question of avoiding the reactions to this overindulgence, this flood of ghee on the fire. It's just that possibly you may walk away from it all, finding it detestful after a while. But you'll walk away a complete wreck. That is the problem. Okay? Yes.
Maharaj, Thank you very much for the nice class. I found it very inspiring and very interesting that you spoke more about the applications, shall we say, of our general philosophy, such as the application on the farming issue and on the Kama, Sindhu, and Bindhu issues. That was quite interesting, I thought. One thing I wanted to ask you about was whether I'm quite interested in agriculture. I was wondering whether you have any information about what the situation is like in India and what it's likely to be in the near future.
According to the current understanding, agriculture means chemicals. So then, who controls the chemicals? That's the battle. The U.S. government, you know, they're offering their incentives, nuclear incentives. India, you let Monsanto and control your agriculture, and we'll give you the precious nuclear secrets that we're not even giving to Pakistan. It's a battle on that level. If you want to know more about these kind of things, of course, we have our Srinathji Prabhu. He could tell you much more than I, from the inside point of view. I'm just, you know, I'm a sannyasi, so I'm just giving you a quick glimpse, you know. You see, what is a very hot issue in the West now hasn't hit India yet, because the psychology in India is still, we want those things that the West has. The psychology in the West is, we've already had these things, it's not working, so you shouldn't want them either. But who's going to listen to that? Who's going to be the first one to cut back? Each one is pointing the finger. You cut back. No, you cut back. The West has already had their day in the sun of destroying nature. So how can they say to developing countries, you restrain yourself, you restrain yourself. We have the superior knowledge that what we did and what we're still doing doesn't work out. Who's going to swallow that? Just like China, they told the U.S., okay, we'll think about curbing our environmental impact if you send us 10% of your GDP every year. Of course, the American public will never go for that. So what is the point of all this? Without sense control and discipline, you can't even be materially successful. This is why it's such a wonderful time to preach, to give Krishna consciousness to others. I'm presenting you this information so you see the golden opportunity. People are in between two worlds. They don't have any secure footing now. That's why we're having such a good time preaching to the overseas Indian students and young professionals in Australia. They're caught between two worlds. They can't go back to India completely. They can't get into Australia completely. Therefore, they're what I call the hybrids. So I give seminars on how to be a good hybrid. Oh, they love it. I bring out all the issues that they're thinking, but they won't say. So I do that service for them. It's a very wonderful time for giving Krishna consciousness to others. You'll see the impact more and more here. And in the future, sometime in the future, you'll see so many of the wonderful brahmachari preachers of Chaupati going to far-off corners of the world, offering Krishna consciousness to others in the future. The world is waiting now. They don't know what to do. That is my point. They don't know what to do. I'm not trying to just stir your mind with, you know, lurid, mundane details. I'm trying to show you. This is what's going on. This is the situation. People are bewildered. So maybe certain mentalities are happening overseas that haven't fully hit here yet, but it will. It's like I have. There's one devotee in New Zealand. He's from Calcutta. He was educated overseas, and he's got his master's degrees in environmental science. But he knows there's no point in him going back to Calcutta and trying to preach based on environmental science. Who's going to listen? But overseas, he's the cow's moo. He's like a big deal, you know. He's Indian, and he has a master's in environmental science. So he's cutting edge. So maybe, who knows, maybe in 10 years from now, you know, once the effects of environmental devastation are more known in India, he'll be able to come back. But meanwhile, he's having a good time preaching on the high levels in university. But here, of course, you have the advantage that there's still some idea of sanity. That is the great advantage. There's still some understanding of what is proper human culture. This is still the land of Dharma. In the recent presidential election, the newscasters, they were glorifying this great event. How this person became president. It shows only in America can this happen. And they were saying that with this one stroke of the election, America has recaptured the preeminent moral position in the world. Just by an election. Suddenly, you know, they've captured the flag of Dharma. They like to think like that. National pride, and they don't know what Dharma is. Here, there is some understanding that's still there. What is a civilized life? What is a pure life? That is the advantage. So, I think very soon you will see that advantage coming to the fore more and more. And we'll be able to see the benefits of how you have so many talented devotees here who have been nicely preserved and being nicely prepared for going on a future rampage. You'll see the advantage of that strategy. So, all right, maybe environmentalism isn't a hot topic here yet, but it's not the most important thing. The most important thing is understanding what is human civilization? What is the goal of the human form of life? That is the advantage of Bart. Anything else?
Thank you, Maharaj. Thank you, Maharaj, for an enthralling lecture. During the course of your lecture, you said that because of this overwhelming influence of Kama Sindhu, there will be a golden opportunity for preachers and devotees to preach. But on a very material platform, the materialists will keep on doing what they are doing. So how do we derive spiritual strength to preach in a situation where this Kama Sindhu keeps on overwhelming the populace in general and devotees also? How do we develop the spiritual strength to bridge that particular gap? Will the golden age, we are talking about 10,000 years or whatever, how will that come about?
The purity of the devotees will make the difference. Never underestimate the effect of the purity of devotees. So it is not exactly the Kama Sindhu that is creating the preaching opportunity. It's the feeling that people are thinking, we don't have it all worked out. The old story of life, it seems to be shaky. We don't have a new story yet. You can see that in the overseas Indian students and young professionals. They need a new story of life. They're in between two worlds. And now in the West, intelligent people are thinking, we cannot go on living like this. Nature won't allow it. That's why I was explaining about the dean of the Yale School of Environment saying, I've had it after 40 years of maneuvering through the courts and trying to bring about environmental change. He said, the only thing that will work now is a change of values and a civil disobedient movement across the whole country, like what Gandhi did in India. So intelligent people in the West are starting to come to that conclusion. So that's what's creating the golden opportunity. And then in India, there is still understanding of what is basic human decency, although Bollywood is working fast to destroy that. But still, it's there amongst the people. It's there amongst the students. So it's going to be a very interesting situation in the future. Even a place like the USA, compared to the rest of the world, the USA is a pious country. One out of three Americans goes to church. They may not have a clue of what real religion is, but they still go to church. So they're wondering. Intelligent people are wondering, what's going to become of us? So you all will teach them. So I'm trying to give a outline of the future terrain. And in the future, no doubt, you'll see so many of the devotees you knew here so well over the decades. You'll see them here, there, and everywhere, preaching the science of Krishna. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.